I think I inadvertently locked us all into this area. That door isn't going to open on its own.
So we need to find a way through it,
Chappelle said. Stand back, Patel said. When they had obliged her, she double-checked that her phaser was at its maximum setting, lifted it, and pointed it directly at the door. The beam caused the door to glow an angry crimson for a few moments, but did nothing to destroy it. So that's not an option, Patel said, finally lowering the weapon in defeat.
And that can't be our focus now anyway, can it?
Lazarin asked. Patel met his eyes and shook her head slowly.
We have to find a way to re-establish communications with the surface,
Lazarin continued.
That is our only priority. We have to warn them, just in case there are no obvious signs of system failure.
And if possible, we need to give them access to as much of the data as we have found here. This is what we came here for, and it would be wrong for them to depart without learning it, Patel added. Lazarin nodded his understanding. Even if Chappelle and Vincent hadn't figured it out yet, he and Devi knew the truth.
There might not be time to figure out how to re-establish communications and escape the chambers.
It was highly likely that all four of them were going to die down there. Voyager. Ensign Icheb was due to return to the surface of the planet within the hour to begin placing some of the newly replicated sensors for Lieutenant Elkins. He had received 3 messages from Bryce since he departed the surface, but thus far hadn't responded to any of them. Until he knew exactly what he wanted to say, he couldn't bring himself to speak with Finn, even via the comm. The tests Dr. Sherrick had run the previous evening had been quick and painless. Icheb wasn't sure what to expect, but had begun to believe, as the hours wore on, that this was going to end with him and Counselor Cambridge engaged in several lengthy conversations. When he entered sickbay at Sherrick's request and found Cambridge waiting in the doctor's office, this suspicion seemed to be confirmed. The doctor was also present, and though he offered Icheb a reassuring smile when their eyes met, the ensign could tell that something was troubling the hologram. Sherrick, however, took charge as soon as the door to his office closed behind Icheb.
"Good morning, Ensign," Sherrick greeted him. "I have completed my analysis of your scans and asked both the doctor and the counselor to join us while we discuss the results."
"Then there is something wrong with me,"
Icheb said, not sure if he was more relieved or troubled by this development. Sherrick released a deep breath.
"There is something different about you, but whether or not it is wrong is unclear."
"What does that mean?"
Icheb asked, looking automatically to the doctor for more information. Sherrick continued.
"Brunali physiology is similar in many respects to that of humans. However, we lack sufficient Brunali genetic samples against which to compare your test results. Again, I would like to stress that what we have found might be within normal ranges for other members of your species."
"But it might not," Cambridge interjected.
"As you say,"
Sherrick agreed.
"What did you find?"
Icheb demanded.
"The issue at hand was your lack of physical response to an emotionally and sexually charged encounter," Sherrick said simply. "Normally, humans in similar situations experience the feelings I believe you anticipated as a result of the interplay between a multitude of sensory and neural receptors and the brain properly identifying the sensory input. Hormones are released that increase respiration and heart rates, but in addition, they heighten the experience, often creating the perception of physical and emotional pleasure."
Icheb nodded for Sherrick to continue. Thus far, nothing he had said contradicted anything he understood of basic anatomy and physiology.
"In your case, your sensory receptors have been artificially blocked by an unusual gene regulatory sequence on your 6th chromosome. As I said, this might be perfectly normal for Brunali. However, it is also possible that the sequence in question was placed there on purpose."
"Why?"
Icheb asked. The doctor stepped forward.
"As you know, you were genetically altered as a child to carry a virus to the Borg. I believe that the sequence in question was also created so that when you were assimilated, you would not experience any undue suffering."
While it is difficult to credit your parents with anything approaching affection for you, given their actions, Cambridge added, it does make sense that they would have wanted to make your assimilation as easy as possible. They expected you to destroy the Borg following your assimilation. They did not anticipate that you would survive that process, or that their little gift to you would complicate your life once you reached physical and sexual maturity.
But if the sequence is designed to inhibit my sensory experiences of pain, why would they also affect my experiences of pleasure?
The same receptors are involved, Sherrick said kindly. All signals are blocked regardless of their origin.
Icheb shook his head. But I do experience pain from time to time.
For example, Cambridge asked.
When someone I care about is suffering,
Icheb offered.
Emotional stress is different from physical stress, Cambridge said. Situations that evoke compassion or sadness are based upon a mental process. Your empathy, for instance, would not be blocked in the same way. Unfortunately, your physical receptors are critical in the normal expression of sexual instincts. While in time you might be able to convince your brain to order the proper responses with no stimuli to engage your mind, it would be a wholly mental process.
Icheb remained still as he processed this information. Finally, he asked,
Can you fix it?
Sherrick shook his head.
Not until we know for certain that the sequence in question is not vital for other normal physical processes. We will run the necessary models, but it will be some time before we can determine if a gene therapy would be appropriate for you.
Icheb felt his face beginning to burn. It was decidedly unpleasant. Understanding that the source of his discomfort was emotional, embarrassment and fear, did not diminish the intensity.
There might be an alternative, Cambridge said quickly.
What?
Icheb asked.
A version of behavior modification. The goal would be to train your mind to respond to various physical stimuli in the absence of other sensory input. As powerful as our bodies are, at the end of the day, our minds are infinitely more powerful. With patience and time, you might learn responses that are currently denied you.
Icheb shook his head.
I will, of course, engage in any therapy you believe would be helpful. But I doubt its effectiveness. I have never felt as strongly about anyone as I do for Finn. The appropriate mental triggers are present, but my body simply betrays me.
We're not going to give up, Icheb, the doctor insisted. The first step in finding any cure is identifying the problem. That much we've done. While we search for alternative solutions, you should continue to engage in any behavior you believe will strengthen your emotional bond to Lieutenant Bryce.
You should also be honest with him, Cambridge suggested. If he truly cares about you, as I suspect he does, he would want to understand what is happening to you.
But can our feelings for each other overcome my genetic destiny?
Icheb asked. Cambridge shrugged. We've never seen anything like this before, so none of us can say to any degree of certainty what the outcome will be. The alternative, however, is unthinkable.
You cannot allow this to warp the development of normal, healthy relationships going forward. It is something to be fought and defeated, not something to which you should simply submit.
Icheb nodded. Dr. Sal approached the unconscious form of Ensign Gwyn with miserable trepidation. It had been a little more than a day since she had briefly tasted the potential for victory over the disease ravaging Nancy Conlon's body.
So damned close.
If she was right, and she was certain she was, that victory was, at the very least, a few steps further away. Steps that would now be denied her by the specific language written by a group of cowardly, sanctimonious assholes into the admittance charter that granted the planet Krios membership in the Federation. That was a problem. The bigger problem by far was Ensign Gwyn herself. She was no longer a donor. She was now a patient. The blood tests had been conclusive. The metamorphic cells Sal required to rewrite Conlon's genetic code had been present. But the radiation exposure Gwyn had suffered when her EV suit was breached by whatever the hell had attacked her on that asteroid had damaged too many of the metamorphic cells for them to be safely used. Sal would need new samples. But if her gut was right, those samples would now be impossible to come by honestly. Sal ran a medical tricorder over Gwyn's still form and immediately checked the results. The things the device could confirm only fortified Sal's frustration. Hormone levels were radically altered. Neural activity was off the charts. Her body's natural defenses had been busy trying to adjust to the 1-2 punch of exotic radiation and anti-proton therapy. It was doing what it knew how to do to cure her. It was changing. It was reverting to its most basic, ancient programming to save itself. The metamorphosis had begun. Sal had seen similar data once before, on Krios. The woman who had provided it, Katali Norol, had died before Sal could help her. The most likely scenario here was that Gwyn would join her shortly. Unless Sal could find a miracle that had eluded her many years ago. After confirming that Gwyn's vital signs were as stable as they were likely to get, Sal took a hypo filled with a mild stimulant and pressed it gently to the young woman's neck. Gwyn's eyes fluttered open. They passed over Sal as she tried to sit up, scanning the rest of the room.
"Where is he?" she demanded.
"Where is who?" Sal asked.
"Sherrick."
Sal inhaled deeply and released the breath in a huff. Clearly, Gwyn had already begun the process of imprinting upon her perfect mate. That needed to stop.
"Ensign Gwyn, I need you to focus and to listen to me very carefully," Sal said.
Gwyn pushed herself upright and brought her legs down over the side of the biobed.
"I'm sorry, Doctor, but I need to see Sherrick."
"I'm sure he's around here somewhere," Sal assured her. "I'll call for him in a moment."
"Dr. Sherrick!"
Gwyn cried loudly to the otherwise empty sickbay.
"Gwyn, focus on me," Sal said more intently. "There was an accident. You were attacked by some sort of organic compound you discovered on that asteroid."
Gwyn looked away, searching her memory.
What? Does that matter now?"
"It does. It's part of the reason you feel the way you do. Let me guess. In addition to craving the presence of Dr. Sherrick the same way you require air to breathe, you're also starving and uncomfortably warm."
Gwyn seemed to do a quick internal physical check.
"That's true," she said, staring up at Sal in wonder. "How do you know that?"
"Because I know what's happening to you."
"Nothing is happening to me. I need Dr. Sherrick. I am for him."
Sal repressed the violent urge to shake some sense into the ensign.
"Prior to awakening in sickbay, have you ever even spoken to Dr. Sherrick for more than a few moments?"
"No."
"Then does it make any sense to you that he has suddenly become vital to your continued survival? Does your desire for him track with any experiences you actually remember?"
Gwyn started to speak, but paused abruptly, again searching her interior landscape for a handhold. Finally, she said,
"What did you do to me?"
Sal wished she could respond truthfully that she had done nothing. In fact, the hormone therapy she had provided to coax Gwyn's limited metamorphic cells into increasing their number, as they did normally every month during her regular cycle, was likely at least partially responsible for Gwyn's current state. The accompanying radiation exposure and anti-proton therapy had undoubtedly exacerbated the problem, but it might not have happened at all were it not for Sal's initial intervention.
"Ensign Gwyn, you have entered a state of heightened physical development unique to your species. You know what the finis rahl is, don't you?"
Gwyn shook her head petulantly.
"We've already had this discussion, Doctor. I am not an empathic metamorph."
"You are now," Sal said simply.
Gwyn pushed herself off the biobed and began to make her way toward the main door.
"I'm going to find Dr. Sherrick," she said.
"Computer, seal main sickbay door," Sal ordered.
Authorization Sal Beta Lambda.
With a series of chirps, the computer complied. At the same time, Sherrick poked his head out of his private office.
What's going on out here?
He asked.
Dr. Sherrick!
Gwyn said, moving toward him and throwing her arms around him.
Please help me. I am for you.
Sherrick looked to Sal in alarm as he tried to gently disentangle himself from Gwyn's embrace. As he did so, both the doctor and Cambridge stepped outside the office on Sherrick's heels.
Ensign Gwyn, the doctor said, slightly appalled at the spectacle. What are you doing? You need to get back in bed.
I need Sherrick,
Gwyn insisted with feral intensity. Cambridge looked to Sal.
Unintended consequences?
He asked.
Later,
Sal insisted, crossing to Gwyn and taking her by both arms as she pulled her away from Sherrick. She spoke softly in Gwyn's ear.
Look at them. Look at each of them. Tell me what you feel.
Gwyn tried to shake herself free, but Sal held her tightly. With serious effort, she pulled her eyes from the wide, mottled face of Sherrick and looked at the doctor. After a moment, she recoiled.
What was that?
Sal asked.
He's not there,
she said.
Very good. And the counselor?
Gwyn focused her attention on him briefly. After a few moments, a new lightness came into her eyes.
A challenge.
Could you also be for him?
Sal asked.
What is the meaning of this?
The doctor demanded.
A moment, please,
Sal requested.
Ensign?
After a moment, Gwyn nodded.
Absolutely.
Cambridge seemed intrigued by the implied compliment, but remained silent.
That's good news,
Sal said, gently leading Gwyn back toward the biobed. As she approached the biobed again, Gwyn placed both her hands on its side, rejecting the attempt to be forced back into it. Icheb suddenly emerged from the office. He took the scene in briefly before heading toward the main doors, which did not open for him. As he moved across the room, Gwyn's eyes followed him curiously. For a moment, they lost their heat.
Icheb,
she croaked. Reaching out a hand to him, she beckoned him closer.
It's all right, Ensign,
Sal said.
Computer, unlock the main door.
Icheb stared at Gwyn. Despite his clear desire not to intrude upon whatever was happening, he seemed to sense the raw need in Gwyn's voice.
You can go, Ensign Icheb,
Sal said.
No, please,
Gwyn said.
Icheb!
He stepped closer to her. Freeing herself from Sal's grasp, she moved toward him, stared at him intently for a few moments, and relaxed almost imperceptibly.
I remember the asteroid,
she said quite calmly.
I remember the black substance and the pain. I remember,
she said, staring quizzically at Sal.
When I focus on the others, all I can sense is them, what they need from me, what I must do and be. But with Icheb...
She shook her head, searching for words.
Go on,
Sal suggested gently.
I feel more like myself,
she said softly. Sal looked at Icheb with new eyes. She had no idea why this young man was different from any other when it came to Gwyn's unnatural instincts, but at this moment, she was simply grateful.
We need to talk,
Sal said to the other physicians.
You think?
Cambridge asked.
In the meantime, Ensign Icheb, would you please remain here with Gwyn, just for a few minutes?
Icheb nodded.
Of course,
he said. Addressing Gwyn, he continued.
I believe the doctors would like you to rest.
Gwyn nodded mutely as Icheb moved closer to her and helped her back onto the biobed.
Just keep her company,
Sal said.
If she tries to leave the room again.
I won't,
Gwyn said, tears beginning to glisten in her eyes. Sal knew Gwyn was beginning to understand her predicament. What Sal did not know was if she was going to be able to fix it.
Admiral Janeway entered Voyager's conference room to find Lieutenant Kim, Commanders Paris and Torres, Captain Farkas, and Seven waiting. Captain Chakotay and Commanders Glenn and O'Donnell, all of whom had just returned from the surface with Janeway, entered the room behind her, and the group quickly seated themselves at the table.
"You have a report for us, Mr. Kim?" the Admiral said with a tight smile.
"I do," Kim replied. "And I'm sorry to pull all of you away from your various research efforts." "No apology is necessary," Chakotay said. "We trust your judgment."
"Thank you, Captain," Kim said. "There have been a number of developments related to our investigations here that have occurred in the last few hours. The most significant is the loss of contact with one of our away teams."
"Which one?" Janeway asked.
"Lieutenants Lazarin and Patel, with Ensigns Vincent and Japel."
"How long have they been out of contact?"
Chakotay demanded.
"A little over 3 hours," Kim replied.
"Comms aren't functioning, so we have already dispatched a rescue team to their last known transport coordinates. They report finding a sealed door that our tricorders and ship's sensors are having trouble penetrating. We believe Patel's team might have found a way to open it and became trapped on the other side."
"So cut the damn thing open," Farkas suggested.
Kim sighed. The look on his face clearly said,
"Can she possibly think we haven't tried that already?"
"We have made several attempts. Our phasers are unable to damage it even on their highest settings. To be more precise, any damage we are able to inflict repairs itself almost immediately. Although the door is a metal alloy, it has previously undiscovered regenerative properties."
"That sounds familiar,"
O'Donnell nodded ominously.
"What about the walls surrounding the door?"
Chakotay asked.
"If you can't get through it, how about removing it from its housing?"
"Apparently the walls of the cavern are densely striated with a plated metallic substance that is equally resistant to our weapons. At this point, the only solution left might be to detonate a small amount of explosives."
"In an underground cavern?"
Janeway asked dubiously.
"I know," Kim said. "We could bring the whole thing down on top of them if we aren't very careful."
"Am I to understand that this is one of several problems we are now facing?"
Janeway asked.
"Yes, Admiral," Seven chimed in. "There are traces within the plating that are similar to an unusual substance I discovered with Ensign Gwyn while attempting to take samples of some of these unusual metals from one of the asteroids within the inner belt of the system. That substance essentially attacked Gwyn and ate through her EV suit before I was able to stun it with my phaser."
Janeway simply shook her head in disbelief.
"I cannot tell you if any of that substance might be released should we try to breach the walls around the door, but should that happen, the dangers posed would be immense," Seven added.
"It ate through her suit?"
O'Donnell asked.
"Seven stunned it, and by doing so was able to bring Ensign Gwyn back aboard her shuttle,"
Kim reported.
"But once they transported to Voyager, the substance seemed to recover. It continued to expand, transforming the shuttle into some sort of new biological entity that I destroyed 2.5 hours ago. It was approaching the ship, and I felt the risks posed by its presence far outweighed the possibilities for scientific discovery."
Janeway started to speak, but held her peace. It was Kim's call to make, and that had to be the end of it. Second-guessing anyone now wasn't going to help.
"I think you should be aware, Admiral, that I have also completed a simulation of the formation of the binary system that suggests that the B star was pulled into orbit of the A star by a terrestrial body. Its remains, along with those of the planets that once made up this star system, formed the B star's asteroid belt," Seven said.
"By what possible mechanism does a planet pull a star into this system?"
Janeway asked.
"Unknown," Seven replied.
"But you're sure that's how this system was formed?"
Chakotay asked.
"As certain as I can be without going back in time to witness the event myself," Seven assured him. "The planet we have named DK-1116 was also formed by unknown means after the binaries settled into their orbit."
Janeway nodded as she began to prioritize the issues before her.
"Anything else?"
Torres took the floor.
The biodome we had reserved for recreational purposes is showing a significant change. The water source our people were swimming in yesterday was apparently once pure. That is no longer the case, and as a result, there are a number of newly scanned metallic formations growing beneath the water.
Let me guess, O'Donnell posited. They are densely plated, similar to the formations located in the walls of the cavern where we lost our away team.
Torres nodded.
They are the same.
Why does it matter that the water used to be pure? Farkas asked. How pure could it have been?
We only knew to go looking for the formations because of the presence of charged particles interacting with the gases in the atmosphere. It was gorgeous to witness, but as Lieutenant Bryce pointed out to me, given the purity of the water, that reaction shouldn't have been possible, Torres said.
Turning to Farkas, she continued,
Pure water isn't conductive. It is possible that the purity was the only thing preventing those metallic formations from encroaching into the water. By disrupting that, we may have thrown the entire ecosystem out of balance.
Where is our most recent geological survey of the planet? Janeway asked.
Seven handed Janeway a pad and rose to the room's small display located on a wall behind the table. Everyone turned to give her their full attention.
As you will note, the metallic substance in question forms a little more than 50% of the planet. It runs beneath the surface in an intricate pattern, seemingly disrupted within the various biodomes by the water sources. In two places, the biodome where Commander Torres discovered the growths, and in the stepwell where we lost our away team, new growths are prominently visible.
Does it pose any danger to us? Chakotay asked.
Impossible to know at this point, Seven said. But if the water sources were strategically placed on the surface to disrupt further growth, we might theorize that those who created the planet had good reason for designing it the way they did.
There's one more thing, Admiral, Kim said.
Janeway turned to face him.
We've been running continuous scans of all electromagnetic wave patterns within the system since we arrived. In the last several hours, a new concentration has been detected, emanating from the system's outer asteroid belt focused on the planet.
Suggesting what? Janeway asked.
That we got someone or something's attention, Kim said.
Janeway sighed.
First things first, Farkas said. Shore leave is over, right?
Janeway considered the question briefly, noting the disappointment on Chakotay's face, before she said,
It is.
XIV. Voyager. Dr. Sal paced the small office fitfully as Sherrick, Cambridge, and the EMH seated themselves, Sherrick at his desk and the other two on opposite outer edges of it.
Well, Elnor?
Cambridge encouraged her. Alone, he suspected, among his companions, he believed he already knew some of the relevant facts Sal was about to deliver. As her story began, however, he quickly realized he had seriously underestimated the dimensions of the catastrophe she had created.
Roughly 30 years ago, Regina and I...
Captain Farkas? Sherrick asked.
Yes, Captain Farkas, who was then commanding the Thetis, and I found ourselves facing a nightmare. While attending a diplomatic reception on Krios, several of our officers were bitten by an insect that on that planet is considered little more than a nuisance. That insect carried a virus, Vega 9, to which the Kreosians are naturally immune. Our people, however, were not, and within days they began to fall victim to the ravages of a DNA damage repair syndrome much more aggressive than the one currently plaguing Lieutenant Conlon. As soon as the infection was detected, we returned to Krios to ask the local medical authorities for any assistance they could provide. They were unusually reticent to help us, citing the passages in their Federation Admittance Charter permitting them to hide much of their medical science behind culturally specific observances.
They had religious objections to offering medical assistance?
The doctor asked, aghast.
They had religious objections to allowing anyone to study their genome, wherein the key to their immunity to Vega 9 would have been easily detected, and which ultimately might have saved 23 of our officers,
Sal replied.
All they were willing to do was confirm that the insect population carrying the virus had been completely eliminated.
Her eyes grew cold and distant as she continued. Cambridge immediately recognized the signs of long-buried trauma.
I was watching our people deteriorate at a rapid pace, with only the resources of a small Miranda-class sickbay at my disposal.
Sounds like hell,
Cambridge noted.
It was,
she assured him.
A diplomatic aide, a young Creosian woman named Katali Norol, took pity on us. She began her career as a historian, and had been privately attempting to reconstruct the century surrounding the Creosian Dawn, their first contact with the Vulcans, as it happens, which ultimately led them to a wider understanding of their place in the universe. She had become aware of certain facts about her people that every administration since the Dawn had worked diligently to erase from the historical record. No doubt you are all aware of the Creosian empathic metamorphs, she continued.
I am not,
Sherrick interrupted her gently. The doctor obliged him with a quick response.
Into each generation of Creosians, a small number of individuals are born that possess a unique genetic anomaly. All Creosians are empathic to some degree, but these metamorphs possess the ability to bond with others, including aliens, in an unusual way. During a period of heightened hormonal activity known as the Finis Ral, these individuals are introduced to their mates, and, through a process we do not entirely understand, take on the characteristics those mates will find most pleasing. They literally become another's perfect mate, while simultaneously sacrificing their own identity to the bonding process.
That sounds horrifying, Sherrick said. What of the rights of these individuals? Are they not protected from this loss of personal freedom and identity? Have the Creosians not found a cure for this condition? You would have thought, wouldn't you?
Cambridge agreed.
The empathic metamorphs are highly prized among the Creosians. They are identified as infants and kept secluded from the rest of the population. Most often their mates are chosen for political or personal gain for their families. Many of them have been used to seal diplomatic relations with other cultures. They are considered priceless gifts, Sal said.
And the Federation allows them to be members while continuing this practice?
Sherrick asked, bemused.
The issue was debated hotly when they were considered for membership. They are a rich and enlightened culture, for the most part, ideal candidates for an organization like the Federation,
Cambridge said.
Given that there are so few of these empaths born, and the Creosians' genetic analysis suggested that over time this variation will likely become extinct, it was decided to make an exception, on the understanding that all metamorphs entering into bonded relationships sign official waivers indicating that they are doing so of their own free will.
They raise the metamorphs to believe that they are special and are under obligation to their society. When the time comes, none of them would dare refuse the honor,
Sal said.
But believe it or not, that isn't the worst part of all of this.
All three men facing Sal grew silent as she continued.
Katali was able to provide me with limited genetic data going back centuries. That data showed that almost all Creosian females are born with the metamorphic variation. A smaller population of the men are also affected, but Creosian society prior to the Dawn took very different views of their male and female metamorphs. Essentially, the women were born into biological servitude. All were meant to become the perfect mates of their eventual male counterparts. It wasn't a problem until they began to encounter other species who didn't share their particular patriarchal fetish. After the Dawn, Creosian women, en masse, began to revolt against their society's customs. It was a time of great civil unrest. Many of them found a way around their genetic destiny,
Sal continued.
How?
Cambridge demanded.
If I knew, I'd tell the Federation to go to hell and make sure the entire universe was told,
Sal replied.
But I don't. No one does. This was hundreds of years, 40 generations ago. What we do know is that over that period, the rate of metamorph births declined sharply, dwindling to something resembling its present reported numbers. Katali allowed me to sample her genome, against her people's cultural taboos, and to my surprise she possessed the variation. Her body had the ability to make metamorphic cells, but it only occurred during specific times of her monthly cycle. Those metamorphic cells are extraordinary, especially when it comes to battling genetic illnesses. She agreed to allow me to use her cells to attempt to cure Vega 9.
At this, Sal trailed off, momentarily overwhelmed by the memory.
Before I could extract the cells, her so-called treason was discovered. She was forbidden further contact with us. Regina petitioned anyone she could get to listen, but the Creosians formed an impenetrable bureaucratic circle around her, and the Federation Council was unwilling to press them further. I was forced to pursue other avenues of curing Vega 9, and ultimately I succeeded. We lost 23 of the original 37 victims. Shortly thereafter, I convinced Regina to allow me to submit my cure to the Creosian medical authorities. A few days after that submission, Katali got us a message out. She was frantic, terrified. She had been examined following our work, and it was determined that she was, in fact, an empathic metamorph. They were in the process of selecting a mate for her. She had refused to sign the waiver and was requesting political asylum.
Sal paused again, collecting her thoughts.
By the time we had received permission from Starfleet to respond to her request, she was dead. I don't actually know if she was killed, or if her newly discovered condition caused her to take her own life. Either way, it was made clear to Regina and me that the matter was considered closed, and we were forbidden to investigate further.
Cambridge was the first to break the silence that followed this revelation.
A fascinating and tragic story, Dr. Sal. But how does it explain Ensign Gwyn's current condition?
When the potential for a stem cell therapy was gone, I determined that the quickest and most certain way to cure Lieutenant Conlon was to use metamorphic cells.
Ensign Gwyn is half Creosian,
Sherrick said, suddenly understanding. Sal nodded.
There was a chance she didn't possess the mutation, but the first blood samples I took showed the presence of the cells I required. I did not coerce Gwyn into parting with those cells, nor did I share with her the unofficial history of her people. I simply asked her to consider whether or not a cultural restriction she never understood meant more to her than the possibility of saving a life. She agreed to every step of this process.
One cannot consent to a medical procedure when they are not provided all of the relevant facts about that procedure. As you well know, Elnor,
Cambridge noted.
A minor detail given the circumstances,
Sal shot back.
I artificially induced the necessary hormonal levels just prior to her mission to that damned asteroid. My concern when she returned was that exposure to the radiation might have damaged the cells. It appears now that they actually increased their number. The cells have surged within her body, probably in response to the anti-proton therapy, and have induced the Finis Ral. She is now under a biological imperative to find and bond with her perfect mate. I was concerned she had settled on you, Dr. Sherrick, but her response to Cambridge suggests that it is still early in the process.
Can we reverse this?
The doctor asked.
I don't think so,
Sal said.
I can't imagine sentencing that poor girl to a life as anyone's perfect mate, but I have no idea how to stop it. I also have no idea why her reaction to Ensign Icheb was so different.
We can help you there, Cambridge said.
Icheb possesses a unique genetic variation as well, repressing his sensory receptors. If the hormones emitted as part of this empathic bonding require a detectable response from the intended mate, he is biologically incapable of providing them.
She can't bond with Icheb,
the doctor said.
Obviously not,
Sal said.
She can't be allowed to bond with anyone. But perhaps Icheb's presence is calming in a way no one else's can be. Since she can't bond with him, she is better able to retain her own sense of identity when she is with him.
Can we seclude her until this passes?
Surely the hormonal levels can't remain at their heightened levels forever,
Sherrick suggested.
The only medical fact the Creosians ever shared about empathic metamorphs with the Federation, the one that I think eventually convinced them to allow the practice to continue, was the reality that metamorphs who are prevented from bonding die.
Once the process has begun, it must be completed, Sal said.
But you said that generations of Creosian women found another solution, Cambridge interjected. So there has to be a way. Perhaps we could reach out to the Creosian authorities and explain Gwyn's condition.
Unless diplomatic progress, of which I am unaware, has occurred in the last 30 years, she'd be brought home immediately, most likely just assigned a mate by her people, and forced to complete the bonding, Sal said.
We can't allow that, Sherrick insisted.
And we're not going to let her die, the doctor added.
I'm open to alternative suggestions, Sal admitted.
May I make one? Sherrick asked.
Of course,
Sal replied.
The doctor's presence does not seem to affect her, to activate this need to bond. Perhaps we should transport her to an environment where neither I nor many other humans will be available to further torment her.
Sal smiled.
An excellent suggestion. Doctor?
The EMH nodded.
I'll arrange for transport to the Galen immediately.
In the meantime, I think one of us owes Ensign Gwyn an explanation,
Cambridge said pointedly.
By one of us, you mean me, right?
Sal asked. DK-1116 Patel and Lazarin stood in the lower chamber, doing their best to make sense of the room's various alien technologies. Vincent and Japelle had agreed to remain in the column room and to download the data from as many spheres as they could into their tricorders. The library of data was large, and their tricorders had limited storage space, but all had agreed that as much usable data as possible would be transmitted to the fleet as soon as communications were reopened.
Thoughts?
Lazarin asked. Patel shook her head and sighed. Apart from limited, unsurprising molecular structures and various ranges of power readings, their tricorders were useless in terms of explaining what the various pieces of this puzzle were and how they fit together. The science officer was reduced to hypothesizing based on observation and what little data she'd been able to synthesize from the initial scans of the planet and all she'd seen beneath its surface. Lifting a hand and pointing toward the illuminated snakes writhing all about the cavern, she said, I'm calling that pure, unrefined Edramaya. That's the base from which all of the experiments on the surface begin. Lazarin nodded.
Seems plausible. This stuff runs throughout the entire planet. It forms the veins of ore in the walls of all the caverns. But down here it has different properties. The luminescence. The tiny amounts of that black liquid that is extracted from it at a fairly steady rate and then cycled through that system over there, he said, indicating the waterfall and the staging platform nearby with the spider legs.
That's the biological portion of it, Patel said. That's the stuff that was used to form the thing I spoke to. But it was mingled with my DNA, so at its most basic level, it has the capability to replicate and transfer genetic material and build from there. It is clearly critical to the experiments the other species were running here.
Like a virus?
Sure. Just a billion times more complicated.
So what we are looking at is a sort of living technology base,
Lazarin surmised. Patel nodded thoughtfully. The potential applications of this are mind-boggling.
As in?
Lazarin asked. If you could properly control and modify something like this, you could grow any number of energy storage and release devices, everything from simple light sources to phasers or warheads with exponentially higher destructive capabilities than even our antimatter torpedoes.
Hull plating for starships?
Lazarin asked.
That could repair itself if damaged?
Patel nodded. There is really no end to the possibilities.
Why is growing these things better than just building them?
Lazarin asked. For us it isn't, Patel replied. We've found other solutions to those problems using the elements that were plentiful on our worlds. But if your species had bigger goals, more powerful enemies you were facing, or shortages of resources on your own world, a discovery like this is a game-changer. Comparable to humanity's discovery of fire.
Only way more potentially destructive,
Lazarin noted. And creative, Patel countered.
The volume of exotic radiant molecules here is most likely the thing that is jamming our communications,
Lazarin offered.
I'm guessing our problem is simply our proximity to this stuff.
I agree, Patel said. Even a few kilometers away in the first cavern, we had comm and transport abilities.
But that door is literally closed to us now.
Patel was searching the cavern above the living ore. Her eyes landed on the large white sphere with the spokes radiating out from its center, some of which were clearly no longer active. One of the things we know this substance does is release energy. It's basically an unlimited and seemingly perpetual supply. It makes sense that you'd need something like that to sustain the energy fields creating the biodomes on the surface, Patel said.
Those could be the hard lines, shunting power to the field generators,
Lazarin said.
And that thing could be the field generator, Patel suggested.
Does that help us?
Lazarin asked.
It might, Patel replied. Up for a little climbing?
If it means we get to live longer, absolutely.
Together, Patel and Lazarin started up the staircases and down the catwalks that led closest to the sphere. It took the better part of half an hour to get as close as possible, and both were breathless when they had reached their goal. The first thing Patel did was open her tricorder and begin to scan.
It's definitely a massive power generator, she finally said.
Lazarin's eyes were fixed on the nearest gray spoke that clearly no longer had power running through it. Finally, he said,
Not that I'm actually anxious to get any closer to the massive ball of glowing death, but I wonder something.
What?
If these are hard lines, and some of them are no longer functioning, doesn't that suggest that these might still reach the surface? Or close enough that we might get a signal out?
A wide smile spread over Patel's lips.
We should try to open a channel.
Lazarin took out his tricorder and used it to search for patterns of transmission. The first few bands he accessed nearly blew out the tricorder and were accompanied by a shrill, screeching sound that nearly deafened both of them as it bounced around the cavern. Finally, he found one that did not. Reconfiguring the communicator in his badge took another few minutes. When it was done, he handed the badge to Devi.
Do the honors, Lieutenant.
It's your creation, Patel said.
You're the commanding officer of this team,
Lazarin reminded her.
It should be you.
It was a simple gesture of confidence and respect. It moved Patel more than anything she had discovered on the planet. Nodding, she accepted the badge and tapped it gently.
Patel to Voyager. Do you read?
A few heartbreaking moments of silence were quickly followed by faint static. Patel repeated her hail.
Patel to Voyager. Please come in. Patel? This is Waters. Where the hell are you?
Lazarin's eyes met Patel's in this shared small victory.
Never mind that, Vanessa. I need to speak to the captain, and you have to get everyone off this planet immediately.
Waters' response was comforting.
Way ahead of you, Devi. Keep talking to help me refine this signal while I get Chakotay for you.
Demeter. Lieutenant Elkins was seated over a data terminal in his ship's main engineering section when Lieutenant Bryce reported as ordered. Lieutenant Benoit was staring at the terminal over Elkins' shoulder.
Morning, Chief,
Bryce said.
Cress?
Where's Icheb? Elkins asked.
Bryce was stung by the question.
Not returning any of my messages was the truth, but he didn't think this was the time or the place for that discussion.
He settled for, I haven't heard from him since he returned to Voyager last night. Elkins sighed.
I really wanted him to see this, but I don't think he can wait.
Indicating the schematic of the planet before him with a stubby finger, he said,
We've been running continuous scans of the planet for several days, but starting last night, I narrowed the focus to the areas where we intended to plant those sensors to determine the precise geometry and location of the field generator.
Bryce studied the display, and one thing smacked him squarely in the face.
The power distributed along the angles we believe are linked to the field generator have remained constant, but in the last 13 hours, New, significantly larger power readings are being detected planet-wide, Bryce said.
Right,
Elkins said with a satisfied nod.
Why? And what does it mean?
Benoit asked. Elkins shrugged.
I don't know. What I do know is that the largest concentrations of increases have occurred in these 6 locations.
The graphic shifted to show magnified scans of several of the biodomes.
That's where the water was contaminated, Bryce realized immediately. Yes, and in those areas, new deposits of the planet's native ore are growing at an incredible rate.
It's like they're making new connections,
Benoit said.
If we think of these deposits more like conduits than raw elements, the structure of this system, of this entire planet, becomes something quite different, doesn't it?
Elkins asked. Bryce nodded as the horrific potentials began to play out in his head.
Depending upon how many water sources we disrupted, we're looking at power surges that will continue to increase exponentially, Bryce said.
But toward what end?
Benoit asked.
What device requires that much energy? It's way more than the biodomes require to function. They're remaining stable.
But if the biodomes have nothing to do with this planet's true purpose, then we have to ignore that and consider other possibilities,
Elkins said.
To my mind, this planet only looks like one thing.
A bomb, Bryce said. Elkins turned to stare at him.
Not necessarily. Then what's your theory?
Bryce asked.
An immediate release of all of the energy moving through this system would be catastrophic to the planet, that's certain,
Elkins said.
But also pointless. Why create something like this if all you intended to do when it reached its maximum capacity was destroy it? But properly focused along these natural vectors here, it might serve a different purpose.
A weapon, Bryce realized. But something that powerful could knock another planet out of orbit, and there aren't any other planets in the system. So why build this and leave it here?
I honestly can't answer that,
Elkins said.
But whatever the purpose was of whoever built this, I have a feeling we're a few hours away from witnessing it.
We need to get out of this star system immediately,
Benoit said.
We're still getting away teams off the surface, Bryce said. Even if we finished that now and started away at maximum warp, we might not escape the blast radius or shockwave.
And we can't bring the slipstream drives online until we have cleared the outer asteroid field,
Elkins reminded him.
We need to go now, Bryce said.
If my math is right, we needed to leave about 4 hours ago,
Elkins said. Galen. Since she had arrived on Galen, Ensign Atar Gwyn had eaten almost 2 days' worth of calories. And still she felt famished. Dr. Sal had filled in the gaps in her understanding about empathic metamorphs and the Finisrawl before she transported to Galen. While she couldn't deny that everything she was feeling and all of her medical scans tracked with the diagnosis, she still found it impossible to believe that very soon she was either going to become the perfect mate of one of her fellow officers, or die. She was less clear on why this was happening to her. The odds of her injury on the asteroid and the life-saving radiation she had received resulting in this condition had to be impossibly long. But then, math unrelated to navigation and speed had never been Gwyn's strongest suit.
I hope whoever becomes my perfect mate likes their women curvy, she said miserably.
What would happen if they didn't?
Ensign Icheb asked. Gwyn stared at him open-mouthed for a moment.
Is he trying to make this worse?
It was nice that she didn't simply know the answer to that question. Unlike every other individual Gwyn had come within a few meters of since she had awakened, to her, Icheb remained a cipher. With him, there was no urgency, no need to become. With him, she felt almost normal. Except for the constant hunger. She decided he was asking out of simple curiosity and ascribed no other motives to the question. Clearly he cared enough to accompany her here, despite the fact that helping her remain sane was not among his many duties. She had embarrassed herself enough already when she was told she was being transferred to the Galen and practically got down on her knees and begged him not to leave her alone. Now that she was here, she understood the wisdom of the move. There were so few organic people on this ship, and none in the medical bay other than herself, Icheb, and Lieutenant Conlin, who remained comatose. The constant humming pressure she had felt on Voyager, the physical possibility of connection with every individual she encountered, had diminished significantly. She was simply left with an aching emptiness in the center of her being that had to be filled, and could only be filled by giving herself completely to another. Her prolonged silence seemed to trouble Icheb, who suddenly said,
"I'm sorry, Ensign. Did I offend you?"
"No, not at all. I mean, yes, but it's okay." The confusion on his face was almost funny. He hadn't been with the fleet long, but now she wondered why she had never sought out his company. She'd made a point of getting to know every eligible male she served with since the day she boarded. But even before this madness had seized her, she'd never thought to give him the time of day. "He's just so young," she decided, though she was all of 4 years older than he. "I don't know all that much about the bonding process," she finally admitted. "It's not something we talk about. So few Creosians are born metamorphs that really they're the only ones trained to deal with this." After a pause, she added, "I guess if the person I ultimately choose really had a thing for skinny partners, I'd stop eating for them. I mean, I'd eat enough to live, but I wouldn't want to be anything other than what they wanted me to be."
"The doctor will find a way to reverse this condition," Icheb said gently.
"Why were you here?" she suddenly thought to ask. "I mean, on Voyager. Why did you come to see him? Are you sick?" Icheb's face paled as he shook his head.
"I am fine."
"Icheb, you are a terrible liar."
"It's a personal matter, Ensign," he insisted.
"A personal matter?" she demanded. "Are you kidding me? More personal than your entire life being turned upside down by a ticking genetic time bomb you weren't even aware was inside you? In the last few hours, Icheb, you've learned more about my personal life than my mother ever knew. I don't have a choice right now. I'm an open book to you. Would it kill you to return the favor?" Icheb appeared stung. She was being too hard on him. He was trying to help her, and he didn't deserve her temper or her prying. "I'm sorry," she said.
"No, I'm sorry," he said. "You are right. And oddly enough, my reason for visiting the doctor was not entirely different from yours."
Now she was intrigued. He went on to explain quickly the broad strokes of his own genetic time bomb. When he had finished, she said, "That's why you're not a problem for me. You are physically incapable of bonding in the way my body requires."
"I realize that this cannot be a permanent solution," Icheb said, "but I will gladly keep you company until this is resolved if you find it helpful."
Gwyn felt herself smiling in gratitude. "You're one of the good guys, Icheb. I know what Finn sees in you." Icheb shook his head.
"Even if he does see whatever that is, how likely is it that we will be able to have anything resembling a normal relationship if I am physically incapable of responding to him?"
"Look," she said simply, "I'm not going to pretend that sex isn't a great thing or an important part of an intimate relationship. But I've had plenty of it, enough to know that while pleasant, it has very little to do with sustaining a relationship. You can easily have sex without a relationship, and there are plenty of relationships that never include sex. There are a million other things that attract us to a person and keep us around long after the physical desire fades. Those are the things you want to cultivate if you really like him and want something deeper." Icheb nodded.
"I understand, in theory. But I would be lying if I said I wasn't looking forward to enjoying a physical relationship with him. Now that it seems possible, even though I guess it isn't, it's almost all I can think about."
Gwyn laughed aloud. "That makes you normal, Icheb. And who knows? If you're so certain they're going to be able to help me, what makes you think they won't be able to help you, too?" Icheb shrugged.
"Nothing about my life has ever been normal. But until now, I never wished that it had been different. I thought I had escaped my parents and what they did to me long ago. Now it seems like no matter how far I get away from them, what they intended will always take precedence over what I want."
I know what you mean. I had to leave Krios to get away from everyone's expectations. I never really felt free until I joined Starfleet. I remember worrying that I would miss them so much, all the people I left behind. A few months after I entered the Academy, I had a dream that I